This is Karen Dubas with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. It is Friday, July 23rd at 10 a.m. I am with Troy Burris, Tom Stanton, and Joby
Dangannon
of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and we are going to conduct a phone interview with Ronald Marcus, a former OTS examiner.
Announce yourself.
Troy Burris, FCIC.
Hello, Troy. This is Ron Marcus.
How you doing today, Mr. Marcus?
Very good. How are you?
I'm very good. I just wanted to let you know that I'm here with Tom Stanton, Joby Dangannon, and Karen Dubas. We're all with the FCIC, and we just appreciate you taking the time this morning to talk with us. And we're just going to go over some just general questions and things about your experiences and time when you were with the OTS. And in specifics with Lehman Brothers, and hopefully you can give us a lot of good information that we can use in our work.
Okay, very good.
I'd like to first start off, Mr. Marcus, with just basically getting a little bit of your background, your educational experience and your and job experience.
Yes. My a bachelor's degree in economics, with a concentration in finance. I've worked in both the private and the public sectors. In the private sectors, I was with several major financial institutions, foreign and domestic, and in the public sector, I was with two federal banking agencies for a total of about 14 years, the OCC and most currently with the OTS. I am no longer with the OTS, so I left the OTS at the end of last year to join Hudson City Savings Bank as a chief risk officer, where I am currently employed.
And how long were you with the OCC? From what years?
I was with OCC for about 4 years, in the beginning in 1992 through 1996. And with the OTS from April of 2000 through December of 2009.
Okay. We're going to focus on your time when you were with the OTS. And what I'd like to get from you is the different positions that you held at OTS, what you started at, and what you evolved up to, like your final position there. Can you describe that to us?
Sure. I came to the OTS. OTS is the federal banking agency, you know, for thrifts. I came in as a general bank examiner, and initially working on examinations of small to some medium-sized thrift institutions. At the OCC, in contrast, as you may know, they are tasked with supervising the examination of commercial banks versus the thrifts, which have historically been home lenders, but over the last 20 years or so have gone into more commercial real estate, into a large to a smaller some commercial loans. But I spent a number of years as a general, as I say, a general examiner, looking at various phases of examination, asset quality, capital management, earnings, liquidity, and sensitivity. These are the CAMEL factors that the bank examiners look into when they're examining a bank. I think it was 2001, my team began to supervise, examine Lehman Brothers Bank and Lehman Brothers Holding Company. Because earlier, a year and a half earlier, the Lehman purchased Delaware Savings Bank, a thrift, and converted it to Lehman Brothers Bank, you know, for as a mineral part of the mortgage origination platform. So our group was responsible for the examination of the thrift and the holding company, really beginning in, I'd say, 2000. I was not involved in the first exam through the end, really. My last examination was concluded in August of 2008, just about 3 weeks before Lehman declared bankruptcy. I also was examiner in several larger institutions under the OTS supervision, for example, Sovereign Bank and also GE Money Bank. So there are a number of larger financial institutions that the OTS has supervised in more recent years, that was 5 to 10 years. But the bread and butter of my work and most examiners' work were the traditional thrifts. But again, I had experience in the commercial and investment banking over my career, over 20 years.
When you were doing these examinations, how many people were actually on site for OTS doing this work?
Well, all the time, there were current examinations of the thrift, Lehman Brothers Bank, and the holding company. There are more people engaged in the thrift examination. That was, that was obviously the primary reason why we were, in fact, also had some supervisory responsibilities with the holding company. It was all about, the fact that the thrift was under the supervision of the OTS. In terms of the holding company, we would have four or five examiners on site for about 3 months during the year for that specified period of time I mentioned before. For the thrift, there might have been 8 to 12 people, some specialists included.
And you generated reports. How often were reports generated when you were out there doing these examinations? Was it like once a quarter, once a month?
Well, our examinations were once a year for both the bank as well as the holding company. However, during the year there was surveillance based upon certain reports that we received by people in the office, in this case in Jersey City. And occasionally there was correspondence and old telephone calls back and forth, so several meetings, as the thrift grew and acquired other companies as Lehman built out its origination platform for subprime and, more importantly, Alt-A mortgages. But to answer your question, there were just two examinations up until the beginning of 2008 when the OTS decided to have a continuous examination of three of the holding companies, so Lehman Brothers Holdings, Morgan Stanley, and Merrill Lynch. And at that time, three examiners were put in place as examiners in charge to be responsible for the holding companies. That continuous examination was obviously ended not too many months after it was started because of the failure of Lehman Brothers in September.
And so in 2008, were you the examiner in charge of the exam on Lehman Brothers Holding?
That's correct.
Okay. And had you been the examiner in charge prior to 2008 for Lehman Brothers Holding, or was it just in 2008?
I also was in charge for the examination in 2007. And an assisting examiner in the prior year examination.
Okay. Who did you interact with at Lehman Brothers Holdings? Who was your direct point of contact?
Laura Vecchio. She was the, I'm not sure if I get her last name correct or not, but she was the point of contact for both the OTS and the OCC. I'm sorry, the OTS and the SEC. And later on, during 2008, when the Federal Reserve came in, she also was a coordinator. But she had responsibilities dating back to, I think, 2004 when I believe Lehman Holdings became a CSE.
Did you interact with people in the risk department with Lehman, like the chief risk officer or anyone along those lines?
Oh, yeah. I mean, she was a coordinator. I interacted, you know, I had meetings with a number of different people. But she was our coordinator, and I think it's maybe somewhat important to supervisors went through her. She arranged the meetings, and she was at most of the meetings. And the OTS did not independently call people for meetings without going through her. She would arrange everything and coordinate all the meetings. So there wasn't, you know, as much free flow of communication as there might have been. Typically in bank and thrift examinations, when examiners can, in most cases, just call or just or walk into a person's office and talk about things. But in any event, yes, I had fairly regular contact with certain individuals and including quite a few individuals in the risk management department over the period that I was either participating in or an examiner in charge of the holding company.
Hi, this is Tom Stanton. Let me ask a couple questions, if I might. First of all, you were there during a great period of time from our perspective, because we can learn from you, from 2001 to August of 2008. When did you first think that something was difficult with this company, that there were clouds on the horizon? I don't quite know how to phrase it.
Yeah, I think that not any difficulty as such, but probably in 2006 we we learned that, for example, the spreads in the in residential lending, that is the old day in the subprime, were tightening because of competition, and they were not getting, you know, the returns that they got in the past. They were one of the largest Alt-A originators, and of course they took that right through the securitization process, which really where the profits were. It was a fully integrated platform. It worked very well for quite a few years. But in any event, I guess we saw, you know, some more challenging business conditions, but nothing really of any concern, you know, from a regulatory or even a risk management perspective. Certainly, I would say towards the end of the fourth quarter of 2006 and in 2007, we saw some of the beginnings, the rumblings, you know, of some turned out to be some very serious difficulties in the non-traditional lending markets, the old day. And they were, as I mentioned before, a major player. There was some businesses, Century and others, even smaller institutions that had some serious issues, you know, in that particular space. And in June of 2007, there were these problems with the Bear Stearns funds, and there was substantial dislocations in the market in the summer, particularly in late August and late July and August of 2007. So I think that we were really focused on the business and risks and the financial risks beginning in the examination that began, I believe, probably in June or July of 2007.
And
that was really the beginning point of it, and that coincided, you know, with some of the major changes that were taking place in some of the major businesses of the firm.
What kind of changes do you mean?
Well, the beginnings of the implosion of the subprime and all the marketplaces, and during I think it was in maybe at the end of August 2007, Lehman closed down their subprime originator on the West Coast. We had several people. OTS examiners, in fact, there at that time, they were told to stay there, you know, for several weeks and told, you know, they essentially closed down. So there was, you know, obvious signs in the marketplace at that time that this part of the residential lending market, you know, was under severe distress, which, you know, continued throughout the third and fourth quarter and into 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really when was the beginning of the end, you might say, end of the financial crisis that began. I know as a subprime crisis in the beginning, the end of 2006 and continuing right through 2007. 2008.
So if we go back to that time series again, 2001 to August of 2008, what kind of a job, and over time, over that period, what kind of a job was the Lehman Risk Management shop doing in terms of monitoring risk and also maybe anticipating risk?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that first of all, I should say that we believe that the The risk management for the Global Risk Management Department was a substantive department, and it was run by well-qualified professionals. Madeline Antonic was head as long as I was involved. I don't know when. I think that she began in the early to mid the 2000s. I don't know the exact date, but she was the risk manager during the 2007 examination. As you know, the there's a change in CROs, and I think it was September 2007. But in any event, the risk management department, we had no issues. We thought that they were doing a good job. We reviewed the reports. We had interviews, with Madeline, and others. We did not have, as I intimated before, a large resource dedicated to the holding company, as opposed to the SEC or later on the Fed. So, and we were not there on a continuous basis, only for 2.5 or 3 months. So we did the best we could, given the very limited resources. We had meetings, we had high-level meetings, we saw their risk reports. So I think we had a good understanding at a higher level. We didn't have the resources to drill down and talk to the quants and look at the models that kind of detail. But again, I think that we did a good job in reviewing that very critical function. We did spend more time as it became more evident that there were some serious issues, business issues which were leading to financial pressures and later on substantive losses in certain of the business lines, and particularly the resi mortgage and later on the commercial real estate. And there were also problems with leverage loans too.
Go ahead, sorry.
So I think that we did review risk management. That was part of the components of the examination process. Risk, was one of the components. CORE, risk was one of the components. We spent as much time as we could looking into the risk and looking at reports and talking to risk managers, the managers, Paul Schotten and Goodman and several other people.
You mentioned that Ms. Antonchik at some point left. Did that change the quality of their risk management unit, or did things pretty well continue as before?
That's a very good question. That's excellent. In my opinion, at the time, and it couldn't be substantiated because we were regulators on the scene. We had limited access, but sufficient access, to the to management. But having been in the business myself, as I mentioned before, on the other side, and then coming over into the regulatory supervisory work in the government, I personally was very suspicious about that move. And that's before a lot of we learned a lot of things, and in particular conclusions that were made in the examiner's report, which really was substantiating what I believe to be the case, and that is, very frankly, in my opinion, that she was removed from that position. And I don't think maybe I shouldn't be extending, but my own personal opinion is that was not her preference. She was very well regarded, I think, by the agencies, the banking agencies, by the rating agencies, and and also, you know, by the people, you know, in her department. I think that she was getting in the way, frankly.
And was that
she was getting because she was resisting the high levels of concentration that were building up in the illiquid asset classes, namely commercial real estate, which really, in my opinion, was a death knell of the company, and leveraged loans and principal investments. But really, it was the commercial real estate more than anything else that I believe has unfortunately resulted in the failure of the firm. But I think that the risk management had identified, you know, the risks here, and there was a huge concentration, and that I can't say that, you know, enough. Just an outsized concentration in illiquid assets. The Archstone transaction was extremely important. It was kind of a watershed transaction, there was evidence, you know, that we saw from reading the examiner's report that she was not fully participating in those meetings. And, you know, and I think that the department itself, you know, had some serious issues with regard, you know, to the going over these limits of the concentration. Management, in the end, and maybe in the beginning, in the middle, really, I think, made an overrode many recommendations by and decisions and limit excesses and so on by the risk management department. So again, and you know, I think that in our opinion, it was management, you know, that took the responsibility, you know, for the what happened to the firm.
Now, the examiner's report makes really discouraging reading. How much of this was perceptible in 2007?
Well, I think that reading the examiner's report, there are certain things that I was not aware of, like the repo 105. I don't think other third parties were aware of that either, except Ernst & Young. But, you know, I think that just a review of these risk reports, you know, very clearly showed, you know, that there were continuing, you know, excesses, limited excesses in that area, and particularly in the commercial real estate. I think at the time that the Archstone deal was approved, the risk managed the real estate limit was about $720 million, and they made a $21 billion commitment. Of course, that's not all risk, but that was a huge, you know, commitment, and they went over their limit, you know, by about $500 million. And they had, you know, issues with continuing issues with that limit, you know, for months. And they and was, you know, in my opinion, you know, just kind of papered over by continually increasing, you know, the risk appetites, and doubling in effect, you know, in a period of about a year or so. So I think that you know, that was, you know, my impression anyway, and other people, you know, the OTS. We saw some very disconcerting trends in the beginning of that examination.
And from both a theoretical point of view and in terms of practical, really down-to-earth realities, What were you in a position to do about it as you watched this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that at that time we were we did not do anything, you know, except mention to management that during the closing meetings that we noticed that that there were some failings in risk management. But we didn't actually communicate anything formally until June of 2008, when a letter was written to Richard Fuld by the regional director, Michael Finn, and concerning maintaining adequate, I think it was a 10% leverage ratio and a couple of other things. So I think that although we had a responsibility for the holding company, I think that we were not probably as active as we would be, as we were in fact with the savings bank. I think our primary responsibility we understood we had a holding company responsibility as well, but we were not, you know, active, you know, considering the application of any, you know, formal restraints on the holding company, although we did, you know, we're obviously, you know, very, you know, concerned with the increasing levels of risk and later, you know, substantive losses. I think we performed our responsibilities, I think, as best as we could, you know, given the resources that we had. We always dedicated several examiners to the annual examination, and we between examinations we reviewed the operating results and financial condition of the holding. I think that the SEC was regarded, you know, as a primary regulator, I think that we in no way just assumed that they would do the right thing and actively necessarily regulate and supervise the holding company. But nevertheless, they were there. They were there since 2004. And there was practically no communication between, you know, the two agencies. So.
Can you talk about that a little more? That's because you were on site at different times, or because they were really only concerned with a set of issues that you weren't concerned with? Can you talk a little about sort of the overlap, but at the same time, the differences between the two agencies?
Mm-hmm. The SEC was on site on a monthly basis, or even more frequently, I think, you know, as necessary for the beginning, really. I don't know. I think, to my knowledge, they didn't make annual examinations. It was more surveillance, you know, of the risk management process. At the holding company, we really did not have any interaction, you know, with them. We received there was a quarterly CSE report that was generated for them under the CSE guidelines. We did look at that, but I'm sure that there were times that we were both there, but we were not aware of each other's existence.
Okay.
At the examinations, we never bumped into each other. We never had any joint meetings or anything like that.
Thank you. This is good.
Hi, this is Donna. Can I take you back to something you mentioned a few minutes ago about Bear Stearns? You noted before we went more specifically into risk management that sort of the beginning of looking at things differently was in June 07 when there were problems at Bear Stearns and a substantial dislocation of the markets.
Yes.
Can you talk specifically, I take it you're talking about the failure of the BSAM funds?
Yes.
Which was in July of 07. Can you talk specifically about the failure of the BSAM funds and whether you, in your regulatory capacity, viewed that as causing dislocation or foreshadowing dislocation or showing? Can you talk a little bit about the impact of that? Whether it was a mm-hmm. cause or a victim.
Right. Well, I really cannot provide any comments on that. I'm not very knowledgeable about the details of the fortunes of those two funds.
Fair enough.
Other than the fact
I'm just asking sort of how it was perceived from your shop. You mentioned that it was perceived in some fashion.
See, our shop is serious. Another probably the most serious indication of what was to become a major dislocation. In the at that time in the subprime, and then shortly thereafter the old A marketplace. I think those obviously were very public events. Bear Stearns, large multi-billion-dollar funds. They did decide, I believe, to inject funds into at least one of those funds. Again, I don't remember the exact details. That was my understanding. Is that? Reading from the media reports, but I think it just obviously heightened our concerns regarding what was happening in the rapidly deterioration conditions of these of the subprime marketplace. There were rumblings, as I mentioned before, towards the end of the prior year, in the first and second quarters. I think that I think things really began in earnest in June, and then we know what happened thereafter.
I have one question going back to when you in 2007. Presented information to Mr. Fuld and the leadership that they were exceeding their limits. I take it they weren't surprised by this finding.
No, they knew it. First of all, I should say that I never met with Mr. Fuld, although. In the beginning of our continuing examination program, senior managers of the OTS met with Fuld and also John Mack and also Merrill Lynch. But I had none of my team. Or anybody on the either examination teams had any contact with Dick Fuld.
So how were they reacting when you told them, not Mr. Fuld, but senior management, that they were exceeding their limits and that there were some clouds on the horizon that were giving you concern?
Well, I think that they didn't try to cover it up, but they basically said These were temporary excesses, there were emails and so on, you know, that were generated by risk management and you know, from the business back to the risk management, and the risk appetite limits were increased. And you know, I think it's very clear that was happening. I remember that. Then I was looking at risk reports back in August of 2007, and you know, I saw it, and others saw these numbers. We're very well aware of that Archstone transaction and how enormous it was, for the firm, and it did have consequences. You know, they went over that the limit, I think that we continued to monitor, during the examination. But it was, something we understood would happen. But that was it. We knew that they had exceeded their limits. But again, they just pushed the limits up, eventually, it became, there was less of an overage, and I don't remember or don't know, what the numbers were in November or December of 2007. But I think that most of that, was overage was eliminated. When those risk appetite numbers were increased, I think all the way up to 4.5 eventually. So, as you can see, the firm was taking more and more risk over a relatively short period of time, and that appetite went from like 2.2 or 2.3 up to the mid fours. So this is what the management chose to do. They chose to place bets on illiquid assets.
Were you the examiner in charge for the savings bank as well as the holding company?
No, I was not.
Was there communication between you and the examiner in charge of the savings bank as developments started occurring? You mentioned the first clouds, '06, end of '06 with the subprime market and moving forward.
So we were in constant communication. We had a joining at company headquarters, and we were all on the same team. There's some people who worked on the holding company that came in from other regions, I knew very well my team members who were running the savings banks in examination, and they are very well aware of deteriorating underwriting standards for several years. This was no surprise to us. We were concerned, and in the report of examination for the savings bank, we had quite a few corrective actions and matters requiring board attention with regard, to the savings bank problems in the Alt-A space. That's where they were most represented, not nearly as much in subprime.
And did I guess you might not know this because this wasn't precisely your area. Did the savings bank undertake the corrective actions? In other words, were they, even while the holding company was taking on more risk, was there a different posture or was there a similar posture at the savings bank level?
They followed through on what they had it to. Sometimes they were delayed, and we were not happy with the progress being made on correcting the weaknesses that were found in the examination reports. And I think that over the years, The impression was that management was not as responsive and as timely in their response as they could have been. So I think that those are comments that I heard personally. You know, when I was on the savings bank, I think that I didn't have any real issues, but there were issues, I'm sure, for those that were working doing other parts of the examination of the savings bank.
You've talked a lot about the increasing risk appetite on the for illiquid assets in November of 07. Were they perceived as illiquid at that point?
Oh, sure. Yeah, everybody knew what the illiquid assets were, and I mean, these illiquid assets were not even in the best of times they were illiquid, but a lot less liquid, if you will, than they became towards the middle, the end of 2007 into 2008. You know, commercial real estate leverage loans, principal, you know, positions taken, debt and equity. Now, these are not liquid market instruments.
Were there discussions?
I think that the markets were, you know, remember that they, you know, the commercial real estate markets and the residential markets, you know, were thriving in 2004, 2005, and 2006. Again, you know, the firm wanted, you know, to increase its market position, wanted to move up higher in the league tables, and it decided, you know, to put a lot of its capital and eventually its life on the line in these illiquid asset classes, particularly the commercial real estate. Basically, what happened was, you know, all Wall Street works on the moving, the Curtis expression, probably the moving in the storage.
Mm-hmm.
Commercial banks, to a large extent, particularly the smaller and medium size, not as much in, you know, the money center banks, but they basically originate business, equity, debt, you know, and subdivisions thereof, and then distribute mostly, you know, through sale, you know, to investors, routine plain vanilla sales of debt and equity, or in the case of residential mortgage loans and to a very large extent commercial real estate loans through the securitization market. And all the Wall Street firms of the stature of Lehman, you know, had very large securitization departments, and they needed product, you know, originated product in order to, you know, to securitize, slice and dice these loans, you know, and for eventual distribution into the global marketplace. But they got caught. They got caught when the music stopped. There was no real market, you know, for these assets. Certainly, in the beginning, the residential ones, and then later on, the leveraged loans and the commercial real estate. So they got, basically, it was hung inventory. They had too much inventory on their balance sheets. They couldn't distribute it. They had to eventually sell. And they began, you know, a good process of selling off, you know, these illiquid assets beginning, you know, towards probably the last quarter of 2007 and more heavily into 2008. And billions of dollars, particularly in the commercial real estate, but also the other asset class as well. And it took substantive losses on them. You know, in better days, they would have eliminated more from their positions. And unfortunately, they were stuck, you know, with a very large position in the order of $4 billion in Archstone, in the, you know, several types of loans, you know, bridge loans, and they also took the, you know, straight equity, subordinated and senior positions. So, you know, they were their inventory represented, you know, various pieces of the capital structure.
If we can ask a what-if question, Madeline Antonsek left in 2007. If she had been listened to at that point with the line she was drawing, would these guys have survived?
I think that there would have been a better chance for them surviving. It's really very difficult, you know, to answer that with any degree of certainty. I think that there would have been less of a commercial real estate concentration, but they had already built up a very large commercial real estate position there. I think that, you know, at that point, I mean, that was really it. It was the that Archstone transaction. Was huge. It brought them over the limits, but you know, they had other large pieces of inventory from very large, you know, commitments to SunCal and to other commercial developers, you know, in the U.S. And they also had very large positions in the non-performing assets in Japan. So, you know, I think things would have been better, you know, if in fact she was listened, you know, to, and the limits going back several years, you know, the limits weren't busted, you know, just the beginning in that year, 2007. There was a, you know, continual, you know, going back, continual existence of these overages or over these established limits, you know. I mean, so I can't. It's impossible to answer that question. But she should have remained in that position, and she was, you know, kind of put into a marginal government relations position, just basically to keep her at the firm. I think to me at that time, I believe that this was, you know, like indicative, as I mentioned before, you know, of, in fact, you know, the business taking over, you know, from the on these decisions, and not really really paying any adequate attention to risk management.
Did you ever interact with the board of the holding company?
I never did. I never interacted with the board. I'm not satisfied that the board of directors really provided the necessary oversight in this risk management area. I mean, there's, for example, in the examiner's report, there was a business plan for 2007, and it was a multi-page document, and there's a, there's one sheet, it's called Balance Sheet, Capital, and Risk, and there's four graphs there. Only one graph is to talk about risk appetite, usage, you know, usage. Which in fact doesn't show, you know, big buildup from 1.3 in 2005 to 3.9 in October of 2007. So, the prior exam, the 2007 exam, I looked at minutes of the board of directors, and I really didn't see much, you know, information on risk. So my own personal opinion is that, and we never communicated this to the, honestly, you know, to management. But I think that, you know, reflecting back upon it, I think that they could have done a better job in looking, you know, at risk and the way risk was managed or mismanaged in many cases.
Thank you.
If I could take you back to Bear Stearns for a moment, but this time to March of 08, sort of a more dramatic market event than the BSAM funds, when Bear actually failed and the government assisted with J.P. Morgan's purchase. Can you talk a little bit about what was going on at Lehman then and whether Lehman's behavior was changing at that point and whether OTS's behavior was changing at that point or market views or...
Well, I think that was really the beginning of our continuous examination program, and that may have been the I think I was on site in March just after that event. They experienced some funding difficulties, nothing of any major extent to our knowledge, but it, you know, did have impact because Lehman was a very active, you know, player in the markets and, you know, funded as other players, you know, did in the repo markets over in the overnight market. So I think reputation, credibility, and impressions were and always were very important on in banking, in particular on Wall Street, due to the high level of leverage and the way these institutions are funded. We reviewed on a daily basis the funding of the holding company.
So I'm sorry.
And the same report was provided to the other regulator.
I'm sorry, Mr. Marcus. Did you say in March 08 you started reviewing the funding on a daily basis?
Yeah, March 08. I mean that's. Our new continuous supervisory program really began in February of 2008. But at that time, I was not on site. And I guess I should tell you that although we had this continuous examination program, the examiners were not on site every day. We went on site, you know, to do targeted exams. I did a couple of targeted exams, and we would intermittently go on, you know, between these targeted examinations. And I think there was one examination in May and one examination that ended in August, but there were several times that I was on site, between and before those particular examinations. We did a lot of, we did a lot of off-site too. We had a lot of reports, so we had a review, you know, of the filings, but the internal reports, and we didn't have a permanent office there, and as I mentioned before, we didn't have that real continuous presence as the SEC did, and certainly before this new program, we were only on site before that annual examination.
Was the continuous exam program just Lehman, Merrill, and Morgan?
It was Lehman, Morgan, and Merrill Lynch.
That was it? That was the...
Yeah, the reason why is because each of those holding companies had thrifts.
Okay.
And we just wanted, you know, at that time it was decided that we would devote some more resources, you know, to to those holding companies. There's only one person assigned to each one, so you can imagine that there was not really enough resources, but that's all we had. And again, you know, we believe that the primary regulator was not the DOT. It's not a belief. We knew that it wasn't the OTS, and none of these firms regarded the OTS as, you know, as a primary regulator. It was the Securities and the Exchange Commission.
And if I'm sorry to make you backtrack here, but I don't want to. It's new to me. It's not my expertise. Why, at that point in February 2008, was this decision made? The continuous.
Well, I think the decision was made because there was more risk. You know, that we obviously saw, as well as others on Wall Street, and particularly the large players on Wall Street. And we thought it would be advisable just to have somebody dedicated, you know, full time, you know, to be in those institutions and to be responsible for those institutions and to, you know, follow the published and unpublished information on those institutions. And I think that that was a good, you know, decision that that was made, you know, at that time. And I think that we gained more information from that decision, having you know, three senior examiners in those you know, three holding companies.
Was the primary purpose to have a view into the holding company to determine if the thrift was in danger, or was there a greater purpose?
Well, I think that that was that always, you know, was, I think, the overriding reason why we examined the holding companies. We had holder responsibilities, Homeowners Act, I think in the case of these three holding companies, we wanted, you know, to see not only, you know, the impact on the thrift, but generally, you know, the health and prospect of the parents in general. But it all was really, at the end of the day, it was how is it going to be impacting, you know, the thrift.
And at that time, I guess I'm just wondering, was there any internal discussion that it sounds like you never approached the SEC to talk about the new regime. Is that correct?
No, that's not true.
Oh, okay.
We did approach, but we were not successful in the approach. There were meetings and correspondence that went back probably a couple of years, 2006, 2007. I'm not sure exactly, you know, when it first occurred, but I think that the two agencies, you know, couldn't agree upon, you know, how the two agencies might work together, sharing information, but we tried, we really tried, and I was at a meeting in July of 2008 with the senior people at the SEC to work out an arrangement, you know, where we could share information and even possibly, you know, have some joint examinations. But the effort never really came to fruition.
And prior to July 2008, did such... It sounds like prior to July 2008, you had reached out as well.
Oh, well, they didn't reach out to us. We reached out to them.
And what were you seeking exactly when you reached out to them prior to July 2008?
Well, prior to July 2008, there was correspondence, but there was never any agreement that we, I think we wrote a letter proposing, how such an arrangement might work. At the higher levels, I was not involved, but there was letters, that were written, trying to come to an arrangement where we could work, together, or at least, share information. That was kind of was ongoing for at least a couple of years, maybe more.
Do you recall any reasons the SEC had for not wanting to share information with OTS?
I think that they didn't want to share information. I don't know why they didn't want. We were certainly willing to share information. We wanted to have joint exams, but the SEC was not of that mentality. I think perhaps if the firm had not declared bankruptcy and somehow was able to survive, perhaps something could have come out of that meeting which I attended.
Who was on the SEC
July
side?
Of 2008. But we'll never know. But to be honest with you, we tried. We were not successful.
Who do you recall from the SEC being in that July meeting in 08?
Well, the head guy was Eric Seery, I think.
Okay.
He was head of, I forget, the market, market.
Trading and Markets?
I don't remember.
Sure.
Excuse me?
The Division of Trading and Markets?
I think that's right. I think so. And Matt Eichner was there, and an attorney was there, and one or two other people from the SEC was there, and leadership of OTS was there. Scott Pelikoff led the discussions.
When you say the leadership of the OTS, who would be the highest official on the OTS side there?
Scott Pelikoff.
Okay. Sorry, I'm not familiar with the names.
Yeah, he was running the agency under John Rich at the time.
Okay. OTS would be most knowledgeable about efforts in the 2006-07 time frame to coordinate better with the SEC?
I think Michael Finn, he would be knowledgeable about that. And
I'm speaking specific. You mentioned that there was correspondence that went from OTS soliciting, but you weren't involved in that. Would Mr. Finn be involved
right.
in that? Would those letters have come?
Excuse me?
Would those letters have likely come from Mr. Finn?
I think that I know that he wrote that letter in June regarding what we expected Lehman to do in terms of maintaining ratios and so on. But he became the regional director in I think it was 2007. There was earlier correspondence, at that time. So I think that Finn, if you wanted to follow up on this, I would say start with Mike Finn.
Okay. Was again going back to Bear Stearns. Ultimate failure in March 08. I'm interested in sort of how everyone reacted to that. Did you ever get any indication at Lehman that that because Bear Stearns was not allowed to fail, behavior moved in a direction it might have moved in a different direction had Bear been allowed to fail? or did you ever get any indication, had Bear been allowed to fail, as to the impact that would have on Lehman?
Well, I think if they failed, it would have been much more perilous for Lehman Brothers, because they were the, I guess they would be the smaller firm compared to Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, or Merrill Lynch. And I mean, there was perception in the marketplace that Lehman Brothers was not would be so-called the next to go, would be most vulnerable, in the case of any additional stresses, in the firm's fortunes or the market's movements. So I think that definitely people were looking more at Lehman as the weaker broker dealer than one or more of the other remaining investment banking companies.
From your seat and doing your sort of your cross exams and continuous efforts at Lehman, Morgan, and Merrill, can you tell us anything about their interrelationships or interconnectedness?
No, I mean, really, it's just a typical, trading, between the firms, buying, selling, acting, in underwriting groups, as investment banks, always, have. I mean, there's a lot of, daily transactions that between the firms on a routine business matter basis.
Was that
anything? But we didn't look for it. We didn't see any. We would be surprised if there were anything out of the ordinary business activity.
Mr. Marcus, this is not in any way a legal question. One of the things we're looking at and exploring is just whether the interconnectedness, it's kind of a too big to fail kind of thing, or too interconnected to fail. It's just a question of systemic risk, not legal in any way. But my question is, did OTS perceive that these firms were interconnected in a way that it would be, harmful to, that it would have some sort of domino effect if they collapsed, or I'm not even sure what you saw or what you thought. But my question relates to that, whether they were interconnected in a way that there could be more systemic impacts of bad decisions.
Yeah, I mean, on that level, of course, I mean, the global marketplace are interconnected. It's our global marketplace, has been for quite a few years, and there's tremendous that type of interconnectedness, as I mentioned before, business transactions between the two of them. They're taking positions as counterparties, so where they're expecting holding companies, to be able to follow through, on their commitments, say in the swaps market. I think that. And also, even in the lending markets, too. I mean, there is a tremendous amount of interconnectivity in Wall Street and globally. It's a major issue that will always be. The new FinReg, did not in any way reduce, in my opinion, the growth of these firms. They were not broken up or anything along those lines. So interconnectivity, is a major risk.
Is it one that OTS fashioned its behavior or changed its fashion or changed its behavior in any way because of?
You're asking the OTS reaction to the interconnectedness that what you're saying?
Or if it motivated the way you examined these firms or the fact that you started continuously surveilling all of them at the same time. I'm just, again, one of our charges is just to look at and see what type of effect that had on what ultimately happened.
Well, I don't think
you had a better seat than I did.
I think that, you know, our motivation was what I said it was before. We understood the interconnectivity of the global financial markets, but our charge was, to regulate and supervise the subsidiary and the holding company. I think that really drove our decision to go into a continuous supervisory mode. We understood that the large issue, of all these firms, being supported by each other in a sense, and relying on each other, as counterparties and trades. We saw these issues. But I wouldn't, say that interconnectedness was one of the, important reasons why we decided, to increase our surveillance of these holding companies.
When did you first think that Lehman could fail?
Well, I don't think that we thought that Lehman would fail. I think that, like most people, felt that there would, towards the end, that there would be an arrangement whereby they would, in a sense, be rescued in effect, by through the help of some government intervention to be acquired either in whole or in part by another large global financial services player. So I was not, fairly close to the company, reading their risk reports. I was, obviously very concerned, but I wouldn't have said that I would have predicted a failure, although I did say in my report, my last report, that I essentially didn't think that they would be able to continue, as Lehman Brothers, unless a substantive change, occurred with regard to their very large exposure in commercial real estate, which, I think would have been difficult to make any major changes in terms of selling off or spinning off some of these concentrations in commercial real estate. Now I think that we've learned that for some time Lehman Brothers had discussions with various parties regarding acquiring an interest in whole or in part, the firm. And those discussions became, more heated during the spring and particularly the summer of 2008. But nothing unfortunately was able to be closed.
Was OTS involved in the government decision? The government various meetings regarding whether or not assistance would be offered to Lehman or any potential purchaser of Lehman?
I'm not aware of any such discussions in which the OTS was involved. I'm not aware of that at all.
Yeah, I just have a few follow-up questions.
Thank you.
This is Joe Biedengannon. In 2007, when was OTS on site at Lehman? When were you first on site at Lehman?
I think our examination began, in July. I think it was towards the end of July, beginning of August of 2007, the joint examinations.
And when did that last until? Is that towards the end of the year?
Lasted until I think the end of October.
Okay. When did you first know that Lehman was tinkering with its risk limits in regards to commercial real estate, particularly Archstone?
Well, during that examination, I asked for, we had a meeting with Pantonic, and I later asked for information on risk exposures and so on. So I saw, you know, what the what had been taking place, you know, in regard to risk appetite and excess, and I had written emails and conversations, you know, concerning that transaction, and so it was during the beginning of that examination that I learned about those exposures, particularly in real estate.
So in July of 2007, you knew that if Lehman included Archstone in its risk limits, it would be way above.
Well, it was in July. I would say it was probably towards sometime in August that we, you know, we got we had meetings scheduled and follow up meetings where I requested more detail on risk.
Okay.
So I would say it was you know, earlier in the examination, you know, that we saw those overages.
The examiner report asserts that the management decided to do away with all risk limits for the GRE, the Greg. Were you aware of that at that time, or?
The old limits with the Global Real Estate Group?
Yep.
Well, I mean, I don't know that the reason that they didn't, they had, you know, risk appetite, so they had limits, but I think that there was a, on a transaction basis, there wasn't a limit, and apparently commercial real estate was not included, you know, in a limit on individual transactions.
Mm-hmm.
But there, you know, there were limits in commercial real estate, which, you know, included, you know, the market and the credit risk and so on. But they were in way in excess after that, you know, after the closing of Archstone. And, but I think that there were certain exposures of Archstone that were not even included in the, I think it was the equity bridge, may not have been included in the risk appetite. So, yeah, I mean, my impression is that they were fooling around with this stuff. And they basically, again, the thrust here is that business, you know, drove these decisions, not risk management. That's a shame.
Did you convey your impressions to them that they were fooling around with the risk limits, or?
Yeah, I mean, as soon as I saw, you know, what was going on, and, you know, we increased the limits, and, I could see, you know, that they had historically, you know, increased the limits, you know, in dramatically over a year or 18 month, you know, period to accommodate, you know, the growth in these illiquid assets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they went really high up on their risk scale. They gambled.
And starting in July, did you start getting daily risk appetite reports, or were those sent to the SEC?
No, we didn't get daily reports at that time, no.
When would you get them then? Was it monthly, or?
We were getting funding. I remember we were getting funding reports beginning after Bear Stearns, so we could see the level of their funding. And particularly, you know, in the repo market, and their liquidity pool. I think that was the key, the liquidity pool. But we did not receive daily risk appetite reports.
I want to talk about your report in July 2008. A very basic question, why the lag time from 2007, if you knew about this in the fall of 2007?
The lag time
in issuing the report.
Well, like this report was issued in July, or I think we were on site July 7th. It didn't go, it wasn't completed until about a month later. Well, remember that this is a part of these, this continuing exam. We didn't, I think it was a part of the examination that took place in 2007. We looked at commercial real estate, but not, you know, we didn't go into any depth at that point. And we just, you know, we had to look at the whole, you know, Lehman Brothers global. You know, with just several individuals. You know, and at that time, the world wasn't, you know, coming to an end, although there were significant, you know, indications of increasing trouble to come. This was a part of the, this was in fact my last report that I wrote before September. And also, I should say that during the summer of 2007, you know, commercial real estate was deemed to be, a seriously high-risk business at that point as it pertains to Lehman or other, you know, players in commercial real estate. I mean, the delinquencies, you know, had not really been increasing. And at that time, the sentiment in the marketplace that the damage was most likely limited, you know, to the residential end of the market. That is, you know, the whole day in the subprime and not commercial real estate. But I think next came, you know, leverage loans later on, a few months later, and then commercial real estate. Indicators at that time, you know, didn't indicate that there was a lot of stress out there in the commercial real estate.
And in your report, you state that there were major failings in the risk management process. I know you've alluded to this throughout your interview. Can you just summarize what those failures were?
Well, I think the failings were just the fact that they were continually going over the risk appetite limit, and I think that it was fairly clear to me at that time that management was moving ahead with its interest, you know, in continuing to and earn more profits. So I think that the influence of risk management that the department was fading, you know, at that time. I think that that's really what I meant, you know, by that. It wasn't really the fact that the risk management department, you know, didn't see the these building exposures. I think that there were indications that that probably they could have been, you know, tighter or recommended not to exclude, for example, the real commercial real estate from single transaction limits, and other things that we really didn't know. Until much later on. But there was a lot of pressure, you know, that I believe was put on the risk management, you know, function to go along with things. This is not unusual, and management overrode in many ways what a truly independent risk management function would recommend. I mean, I think that that's pretty clear, certainly from reading the examiner's report. There was a lot of details that I learned, particularly historically, that, for example, on the balance sheet limits, you know, they were, in 2005, they're over, you know, by substantial amounts, but nothing really happened. So, examiner, you know, did a very good job overall, but I think that they touched on some really important points. Including, I'm glad that they included a section on the change in risk management chief person and chief CROs on September. I'm glad that they focused in on that. So I didn't see anywhere that that was brought up anywhere in the media or anywhere else. But that was good that they highlighted that. I mean, and you know, there was disagreement in terms of was any negative impact, or did Chris Mayer, did he do his job? He was certainly a good, solid CFO. We met with him. But nevertheless, I think it was the wrong time, to change matters, at that critical juncture. And that's my own personal opinion.
So was your impression at that time that the very senior management, the Dick Fultz and Joe Gregory, were overruling the risk management process? But was that your perception in the fall of 2007?
I think that's true. I mean, Joe Gregory really was running the, on a day-to-day basis the business. I think Dick Fuld was not as actively engaged, as he'd been, in the past. I think he, Joe Gregory, had major areas in the firm under his wing, including, I think, risk management.
Quick point of clarification. You referred to the July 07 exam as a joint exam. What is the joint in the exam?
The joint is the thrift and the holding company, OPS. And the SEC was not, they were not involved.
I was focusing on the fact that you said you weren't doing it with the SEC, so I was wondering if it was another agency, but you just mean joint amongst the OTS thrift team and
that's right.
The LTS.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Thank you.
It's actually a good segue to agency sharing information. After March 08, it appears that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York was also on site at Lehman, at least daily. Did you share information with them as well? Or did you?
No. Well, we didn't share information with the Federal Reserve.
Did you know that?
I'm aware of it anyway.
Okay.
I mean, you're asking me. I don't know what was going on with at higher levels, at the management levels in Jersey City or Washington.
Mm-hmm.
I would be surprised if there wasn't some conversations, regarding that. But I know that the EIC's pretty sure that I never met with anybody from the Federal Reserve and. I don't know that the other two people met with the Federal Reserve either.
Mm-hmm. No, was
again, there could have been conversations, people above us.
Was OTS on site daily at Lehman as well after the Bear Stearns weekend?
No. We were not on site daily. We were there frequently, but not daily.
Mm-hmm. And the liquidity stress test, would that have been helpful to your own regulation, or?
Can you please repeat that?
The liquidity stress test that the New York Fed implemented, would that have been helpful to your own assessment or regulation of Lehman?
A liquidity stress test?
Yeah.
Is that what you said?
Yeah.
I think so. I think it would have been helpful.
But you never asked for that information.
I think that, I didn't ask about the liquidity stress test that the Lehman Brothers, I can't recall, knowing about that.
I wanted to ask you a question. There's been some press or some reports that one of the reasons why the Fed did not step in and help Lehman was the fact that there wasn't enough collateral or good collateral that they could come in and do something with. Were you aware of any of the collateral or that Lehman held, and if they did have collateral that the Fed could have helped them with?
I was not personally involved in that. The fact that I was out of the country during that critical time. But as you mentioned, it seems that there wasn't adequate collateral, according to what I've read. I think that it comes down probably largely, to what's the value of the commercial real estate. And there may have been lots of other things, too. I mean, collateral, they had, inventory of equity securities.
So they did have, what you're saying is based on the work that you did, you know that they had other types of, they did have some types of collateral?
Well, I mean, there was other, collateral that they had. I mean, in terms of collateral being, positions on the balance sheet that weren't pledged, right?
Right.
They're not enough in the eyes of those who made the decision. I think people in the Lehman may not have. May not have agreed with that. I think that, from what I understand, they thought that they didn't get a fair shake on that. I think that I don't have any direct knowledge of that in terms of looking at, the levels of collateral that could have been, pledged. I think that there may have been additional collateral that they thought, that could have been looked at, or maybe haircuts that were too severe on these illiquid assets. And of course, the valuation of the commercial real estate had been a continuing cause of concern for those in the marketplace. So. We'll never know, I guess, to what extent, if any, the levels of collateral should have been more available in the eyes of the decision makers on that fateful weekend.
Anything else? Well, I think that's it, Mr. Marcus. We really appreciate your time and going over this and filling us in and giving us all this great information. It's going to be very helpful to us. And obviously, I may need to reach back out to you if that's all right. If there's some follow up questions or something that we could get with you, okay?
Well, I'm glad to participate in this very important inquiry.
Okay. Wait a second, one more thing.
Just because, again, you had such a, good or bad, depending on whether you're talking about your life or historically seat, what in your mind was the immediate trigger? I mean, Bear collapsed in
March
of 2008, and I think... as you mentioned, the markets perceived that there could have been a domino panic confidence issue had the government not stepped in. The government did step in, and no one failed for the next 6 months. What do you see as the immediate trigger in September that caused the run on Lehman?
Well, and this is not peculiar to Lehman, banks die because of liquidity issues. They basically, the funds providers, and others lost confidence in Lehman Brothers, and confidence is all important when it comes to financial institutions, particularly, you know, these type of highly leveraged institutions.
But why do you think that loss of confidence?
I think it's very important to mention that, you know, liquidity concerns, you know, only arose because, you know, of the, really at the end of the day, it's these wrong business decisions that were taken to build up their liquid assets, which resulted, you know, in the inability to offload at reasonable prices, which led to huge losses. I think that because of these business decisions and these particularly, you know, in my own view, commercial real estate in the end produced this liquidity crisis. It didn't happen on its own. It built, you know, it was building and building during the summer. You know, after Bear Stearns, everybody's really focused, you know, on the conditions and the with respect, you know, to the to residential and at that time more so commercial.
I was just wondering if in your mind there is any particular event that spooked the market in September of 2008. Because while people were concerned that the world didn't come crashing until September, and then it crashed over a 2-week disastrous period with Lehman and Merrill and the GSEs.
A buildup of concern, you know, when there's concern, when there's provide the funds that were necessary, and they ran out of money. Yeah, but it, you know, it was continuous pressure building, and then bang, you know, their Chase and others just didn't provide the liquidity that they needed. They refused to extend, you know, funds because of what was going on. They were unsuccessful. Mm-hmm. Really, they were unsuccessful in either the sale of the firm or a large position. You know, with the Korean Exchange Bank, that fell through. So there, you know, the marketplace understood Lehman was trying to do something over those months and even going back, but particularly in those, maybe 4 to 6 months before, doing something, but it didn't work. Nothing happened. And they just ran out of time. They were at the end of their string, and that was it. It's not unusual.
Do you think the Fed could have provided life support for at least a few days through its discount window to keep Lehman afloat until Barclays shareholders could vote?
Well, I think my opinion, they should have provided that necessary liquidity. You know, I know that Secretary of the Treasury continues to maintain that he didn't have the authority to do that, but I think in these types of very stressed situations, there is, you know, history, you know, to show that the Federal Reserve and the Treasury, the government in general, you know, can and has provided, you know, support, but.
So the ultimate decision maker would have been Paul.
Or for other reasons that I'm not familiar with, that life support was not, you know, provided, and like I said, that the reason given was what Mr. Paulson provided. Didn't have the authority.
So is it your view that Mr. Paulson was the ultimate decision maker?
Okay, Mr. Marcus, I guess that's it. Thank you again for your time, and if we need any more stuff, I'll be in touch with you, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.